Hey y'all, thanks for tuning in to this week's recording of Redeemer Church of Knoxville's Sunday Sermon. We're really glad to have you with us because we know that there are a million different podcasts that you could be listening to right now. So we're thankful that you've chosen to spend some of your day with us. We hope that this recording will be an encouragement to you and that God, by His Spirit, will use His Word to remind you of Jesus' love. If you would like to reach out to us, we would love to hear from you. To do that, please email us at office@redeemerknoxville.org. We also want to give a quick thank you shout out to Evie Andrus and Parker Green, who you hear playing our awesome intro and outro music here each week. Lastly, if you'd like to support Redeemer in her mission to Urban and University Knoxville, please visit www.redeemerknoxville.org and look for the little give button in the top right corner. Thank you so much, and here is this week's sermon.
My name is Rob Heron, and I'm the assistant pastor here, and I want to welcome you to Redeemer. What is Redeemer? Well, Redeemer is a church. And what that means is that we're a community of people that are trying to learn how to love God and trying to learn how to love our neighbor. And fundamentally, what we believe is that Jesus is God. He is the Messiah, and He's come into the world to die for sins and reveal the love of the Father. And so we, as His people, gather so that we might rest in the great love that He has given to us. And as we rest in His love, we then delight to gather around tables, at meals, in homes, but primarily in reading the Bible and in praying together so that we might remind one another of that great love God has shown to us in Jesus. And as we rest in that love and as we remind one another of that love, we then delight to gather in service so we might reflect the love of God to our family, to our friends, and to our neighbors here in Urban and University Knoxville. And we hope and believe that in some small way that will spill out into the ends of the earth. So that's who we are. We're a community of people trying to learn how to love God and trying to learn how to love our neighbor as we rest, remind, and reflect. And we're continuing in our fall series that we've entitled Questions God Asks. We have a laundry list of questions that we bring to God. And knowing Him involves partly asking those questions to Him, but it also involves facing and engaging the questions that God in His Word asks us. So this morning, we are looking at the question Jesus asks His followers in Mark chapter 4, why are you so afraid? And you can see this passage printed in your bulletin, and you can find it in one of the Bibles provided in your row if you would like to follow along. Mark chapter 4, 35 through 41. On that day, when evening had come, Jesus said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took Him with them in the boat, just as He was, and other boats were with Him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But He was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke Him and said to Him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And He awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey Him?" The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Would you pray with me? Father, we ask that You would, by Your Spirit, make plain to us the meaning of Your word and that in it we might see Jesus more clearly, so we would fear and love You rightly. The substance of Your word is truth, and so would You teach it to us and set us free in it and by it. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. One summer break during my years in college, my friends and I were bored. And when you're in college and you're bored, what do? You jump off of bridges, at least when you're bored and foolish. And so one summer, on many free afternoons, you would find us on this one bridge near Chattanooga overlooking a river 40 feet down. And we would jump off of the bridge into the water down below, hurling our body down into the mysterious waters. But As it happens, that became boring. And so we took it up a notch. And so we would run across the two-lane road on this bridge, and then we would then hurl ourselves off of the bridge into the water down below. And one such afternoon, I'd made the jump into the water safely, and I swam to the bank, and I climbed back up into the, going toward the middle of the bridge, the jump spot, when I saw a car coming my way, and a brilliant thought came to my mind. I'm going to impress my brilliant friend. So I bolted for it across the road, trying to run as fast as I could, being as close to the car as I could to make it brake. And the car braked, and I ran, and I made it to the edge of the bridge, and I jumped up, did my Heisman jump, without realizing what part of the bridge I was at. And sailing through the air, I looked down beneath me, and on one side of me was sharp rock, and the other side of me was the water. And in that moment, it was a coin toss to know, was I going to hit the rock or was I going to hit the water? And in my memory and in my mind, I thought it was possible to wiggle my body midair to try to move toward the left. And when I hit the very edge of the water, cutting through maybe 10 to 20 feet, like a human knife through the water, and crumpled on the rock beneath the water. And somehow, I don't know how, inexplicably, I was totally unharmed. In that moment, I really thought I was dead, and I was inexplicably unharmed. But that moment completely changed my relationship with heights. I don't know that I ever loved heights. I don't know that I was ever a heights person. But from that moment on, I have an immediate physiological response to the mildest heights. So you up in the balcony right now, I don't know how you're not absolutely terrified during this moment. I'm not going up there. When I was a campus minister at Appalachian State, students there like to climb. I don't know why, but they like to climb. And when students on campus would climb 50 feet to the top of trees in the middle of campus, I would have to immediately leave and say, I'm out. Because I would want to empty my stomach immediately seeing them up there swaying in the breeze. And seeing me get weird, seeing my immediate physiological response to heights, students would respond to me always with some sense of, some kind of, why are you so afraid? Basically, they would say, chill. But why are you so afraid? And when anyone asked me that, asked me, why are you so afraid of heights, I would say to them, because when you're up high, you can fall. And also, I just am. I just am. And I think for so many of us, our experience with fear is like that. It's an embedded experience and guttural response to danger. When we're faced with danger, we experience some kind of trepidation or distress or even terror. And if you ask someone, why are you afraid of that? They'll say, because it's dangerous, and I just am. And the question doesn't seem that helpful. So if God in this passage is asking us, why are you so afraid? Our gut response might be, because bad things happen. Because it's a dangerous world. Have you noticed? And so the question seems like it may not be helpful. It actually might seem like it's a question just geared to shame rather than to help. And yet, the most frequently iterated command in the Bible is this: fear not. Fear not. And so if we want to know this God who issues that command, fear not, then we have to engage with this question that he asks us here. Why are you so afraid? Why are you so afraid? What I want to do, looking at Mark 4, is consider two realities that Jesus' question speaks to. A lot of fear and a little faith. One, a lot of fear, and two, a little faith. So first, let's look at a lot of fear. After a long day of teaching the crowds, Jesus tells his disciples that they are going to take the boat out to sea. Why? To get to the other side. It's right there in the text. It's amazing. And if every moment of Jesus' life is meant to instruct the disciples about who he is and what he's come to do, then doing this is intentional, knowing what would happen next, instructing us, Jesus brings them out, and what happens in verse 37? A great windstorm arose. This is no typical rainy afternoon. This is the greatest of hurricane weather. It's weather that's so intense out at sea that Mark tells us waves were breaking into the boat so that the boat was already filling. By every metric available to the disciples, they are in deep trouble. If nothing changes, they're going to die, and soon. They're terrified. For an ancient person, the sea was basically the darkness underneath your bed, where monsters lurk. And here the monsters are bringing up their multi-headed terror to devour the disciples and bring them down into the abyss. But in case we've forgotten, they have someone special on the boat. Jesus is with them. And yet, what is he doing? Look there in verse 38. But Jesus was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. He's having a cat nap, not showing one bit of concern for the storm. And I'm a famously heavy sleeper, afraid of heights, heavy sleeper. It's great. And yet, when we look at what Jesus is doing here, we wonder, how is that possible that he could be sleeping during the perfect storm? And so rather than letting him continue to rest like children, they wake him up. And you can see there, they woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Do you not care? Are you so callous?" And Jesus' response to their cry, it's immediate in verse 39. He awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. With two words, a great storm becomes a great peace, a great calm. And if we really accept what Mark is telling us here, we will have to reconfigure everything in our worldview around this. And yet there's even more than meets the eye, just packed into the language here. The Greek word that's translated rebuke is the same one used in the Greek translation of Psalm 106:9, where the psalmist remembers God bringing his people out of Egypt through the Red Sea and out of slavery, where he says, "He rebuked the Red Sea, and it became dry." And the word translated "be still" is the same one used earlier in Mark, where Jesus authoritatively tells an unclean spirit, "Be still and come out of a man." And so Mark is, throughout the gospel, using every tool at his disposal to identify Jesus with the Lord of all. The Lord who has power over the winds and the waves, all the forces of nature, every enemy, and everything that would terrify us. And with that in mind, with that in view, the disciples' fear in Jesus' action, here's the question in verse 40. Why are you so afraid? Notice, I mean, this question is not simply why are you experiencing fear, it's why are you terrified? Why are you so afraid? Why are you immobilized and crushed by your fear? It's not a question that implies that a normal human response of fear in the face of imminent death is faithless. It's not implying that. It's a question that's interrogating the disciples in this moment what their fear means. What does it reveal? What did you fear would happen? Am I not with you? Did you think that we were just going to sink and that's the end of the story? Have you not yet believed in my purpose for you? Have you not yet believed that I am faithful to accomplish that purpose? And now, I mean, the disciples look out at the calm and the peace, and they are wondering to themselves, why was I so afraid? Maybe you've seen one of these videos that I love that capture the invisible danger prank. And the prank goes like this. You and I are sitting in a room, and it's calm, it's peaceful. Maybe you're thinking deep thoughts to yourself, like, what would Taylor and Travis's celebrity name be? Should it be Tavis or Trailer? I prefer Kel Swift. That's the one I like. And all of a sudden, I jump up, and I throw my arms over my head, and I screech, a hair metal screech, and I run out of the room. And you, without any sign of what I'm looking at, what I'm afraid of, you jump up, and you throw your hands over your head, and you scream, and you run away like you've made your family disappear up and down the hallway. And of course, here's the prank. There's nothing. There's no squirrel on my head. There's no tarantula on the couch. There's no alien invaders. There's nothing. And I've just exposed how empty your fear was in that moment. And I've somewhat cruelly exposed how much fear there actually is apparently in you, just always underneath the surface, that just rose up at any given moment. And in a way, this is what Jesus is showing to his disciples. It's kind of like that. He exposes the emptiness of their fears compared to his promises and his power. He exposes the reality that they're not just afraid, they're terrified, even with Jesus. And so Jesus asked them, and he asks us, why are you so afraid? Why are you overwhelmed by fear? But it's important to note, what kind of fear are we talking about here? In his really helpful book, Rejoice and Tremble, Michael Reeves, he outlines the three types of fear that the Bible speaks to. And the first is natural fear, the fear that's a natural response when another car drifts across the median and is coming toward you and you have to swerve. That's natural fear. The second kind is sinful fear, the fear that would turn us away from God because it's rooted in distrust and his care and his control. And the third kind of fear is right fear, what the Bible calls the fear of the Lord. This is fear that drives us and somehow compels us toward God. Because as Reeves puts it, it's a right response to God's full-orbed revelation of himself. It's not a cowering dread. It's instead a reverence, and it's also a trembling in the presence of the perfection of God, who commands the winds and the waves, who has infinite power, and who is beautiful, who is love. And so should we fear or shouldn't we? Should we fear or shouldn't we? And it really depends on what kind of fear we're talking about. When the disciples witnessed Jesus' lordship in commanding the forces of nature, you see, Mark says in verse 41, they were filled with great fear, and they said to one another, who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? In the original language, they more literally feared a great fear. They don't have less fear, they have a greater fear than what they were experiencing when water was filling the boat. How is that possible? They're not yet fully grasped who Jesus is, but they are on the right track because their fear is in the right direction. Their fear is directed toward this one who commands the wind and the waves. Here, Jesus demonstrates his purpose for us, which is not that we would have no fear by becoming fearless, by conjuring up some kind of courage within ourselves, but instead that we would have a lot of fear in the right direction. It's not that we need less fear, we need a greater fear. And why would we need a greater fear? That doesn't sound exactly right. Well, if we just consider your most embedded, abiding and terrifying fears that you hold within you. You don't have to say them out loud. But if you just take one of those fears and consider, what does that reveal about me and what I think? And really, more importantly, what does it reveal about what I love? Our fears reveal what we love. Michael Reeves, again, he says this, we fear our children getting hurt because we love them. We fear losing our jobs because we love the security and identity they give us. We fear rejection and criticism because we love approval. So if my fear of you rejecting me is rooted in a controlling and sinful love of approval, do I need less fear or do I need more fear? I need less fear of rejection, but how do I get that? How does that happen? It happens as my love changes, as my love is transformed. What I need is a greater fear, a fear that would drive away all other fears, that would swallow up other fears because it's so big. And nothing can do that but a perfect God. This God invites us not to a sinful cowering and terror before him, but a true knowledge of him that would inevitably lead to trembling and rejoicing as we know and grasp his power and his beauty. That fear leads us to love as we grasp how graciously he has loved us and conquered our fears. And so what I need is to fear him rightly, because when I do, the approval of others begins to truly seem so empty in comparison. compared to the unearned and perfect approval that he gives me in Jesus. What I need is the fear of the Lord, knowledge of a perfect love that would cast out fear. And so Jesus asks us, why are you so afraid? He asks me, why am I so afraid? And my gut response may be because there is so much that's absolutely terrifying out there, and because I don't know how to not fear. But this is a living and active question that comes to us this morning to help us to see what's real and to help us grasp God rightly so that we would love him rightly as we fear him rightly. He is the only one worthy of great fear. What we need is a lot of fear in the right place. And Jesus invites us to know this truth. The greater he is in our estimation, the less terrifying anything could be. The greater his love is in our estimation, the more tightly we will hold on to him, and the more loosely and the less fearfully we will hold on to anything else. He invites us to make much of him so that we might be free, so we might know courage as we begin to grasp his courage, his power. And so him asking, why are you so afraid, is another way of asking, why do you make so little of me? Why do I make so little of him? Because as we grasp more of him, we will know that he is not asleep. He is with us. So that's the first thing. We may have a lot of fear, but what we need is a greater fear. That's the first thing. Let's look, secondly, at little faith. We've seen a lot of fear. Let's look at a little faith. In verse 40, you can see there, the question, why are you so afraid, is joined by another question. Have you still no faith? So Matthew wrote another gospel, records the same event. And there Jesus calls the disciples little faiths. He calls them little faiths. Because the trust they have in Jesus is small. It's timid. It's weak. It pathetically grasps at such a tiny glimpse of who Jesus is that they're willing in terror to wake him up and say, help us. Are you going to do something about this? Because they have nowhere else to turn. So I mean, it's not a mature faith. It's not some massive, you know, praiseworthy faith. But that also means that Jesus's response to them is all the more remarkable. We would expect him to say, he would wake up groggy, he's been teaching all day, and say, come back to me when you've sorted yourselves out, because I'm not going to deal with little faiths. Instead, he immediately responds with caring rescue. And we should take into account it's only after he does that he asks his question. It's from the other side of gracious deliverance that he does the work of maturing their faith. And if we reverse the order, if fearful people must strengthen their faith, add courage to their faith before Jesus will save them, we lose everything of Christianity. It's no longer Christianity. There's an invitation here toward a stronger faith. Yes, absolutely. But as Frederick Bruner puts it, what really matters in the final analysis is that Jesus helps us however we come to him, even with little faith. And this is the only good news for fearful people. Because Jesus isn't looking for the self-confident. He isn't looking for the fearless. He's looking for a little faith. And even that is a gift. But if we're going to be people of faith, I think I and we, if we're honest, we want to be like a prophet. We want to be like Daniel, you know, where we're believing that God is going to be faithful even when everything would tell us that we're about to be lion brunch, right? That's what we want to be. We want to have that kind of fearless faith. And yet the reality is so much of our lives involves a battle to just have little faith. Madeline D'Elia is an author, and she writes about this kind of battle. She writes about this moment where she is cutting avocados for her dinner. She's just making dinner when all of a sudden she accidentally cuts deeply into her thumb, and blood goes everywhere. And it's a little bit of a scary moment, but for whatever reason, this bundle of fears that she's been holding within her about all kinds of things, looking at this cut in her thumb, it just rises up to the surface, and it just dread fills her. And here's what she writes. The whole scene was pathetic. Fast forward through tons of blood, and I'm lying in my bed trying not to faint while throwing myself a pity party. And then all of a sudden, I'm asking God a series of existential questions, like if he even loves me, and what's with predestination, and what's romantic love anyway? In the midst of those questions, I whimpered a small, "Give me faith, Lord," prayer in my heart. And instead of gaining an answer to any of my questions, I just believed that God heard me and he was with me in my room, watching me hold a paper towel around my finger with one hand and with the other Googling, when should you go to the hospital when you cut yourself with a knife? And because of nothing I did or any goodness of my own, I had faith. It's a moment of little faith in a fearful person. And the question is, what does Jesus do with that kind of faith? Would Jesus mock this woman for her little faith? Would he tell her to just get over it? Much scarier things out there than a sliced thumb. And this matters because I'm exactly like her. And we are exactly like her because we're exactly like the disciples. Our way to Jesus is no different than what the disciples experienced. There is no way to Jesus except through a little faith. And there is no way to grow in right fear, to grow in trust, except through a little faith. There's no way forward except to come to Jesus as those who are so often timid and cowardly and burdened by terror. There's no way but through little faith. If we do not come to Jesus this way, then we will never find him or miraculously be found by him. We are those who so often fear failure, we fear loss, we fear being alone, we fear success, we fear change, we fear things staying as they are. And yet Jesus invites us to come to him with a little faith, a timid faith, and cling to him. The central question is not what kind of faith do I have, but what kind of faithfulness does Jesus possess? That's the question. He is perfectly faithful. And as we come to him, what does he do with our faith? He does expose it. He exposes the reality that at bedrock, our fears are rooted in unbelief because we grasp so little of who Jesus is. We grasp so little of his control. We grasp so little of his compassion toward us. But what does Jesus do with that faith? In exposing that unbelief, he demonstrates his mercy and his faithfulness to and through little faith. So that learning more and more who he is and what he does for us who have little faith, we would grow in courage. As we come to him with little faith, we grow in courage as we grasp just how kind and just how faithful he is. It's only those who come to him with fearful hearts who can learn that he does have power over the wind and the waves. It's only those who cry out in distress and desperation who can learn that he does calm the storm. Only those with little faith can know Jesus' courage and then grow to fear rightly. And so only those who come to Jesus this way can begin to listen and obey this command, do not fear. How is it possible that we could obey this command? It, of course, would be nice if we had a how-to manual for how to manage our fears, and yet that would be so ineffective. But instead, Jesus' question aims to go to work in us so that with little faith, we might ask him by his Holy Spirit to give us right fear. Where you experience fear of loss, fear of sickness, fear of the future, that these would be occasions for greater trust and obedience as we come to grasp his strength, his courage, his fearlessness, his faithfulness. Why are you so afraid? Our unbelief response, our gut response is, well, because there's just so much that is terrifying, and that's just the way that I am. Because I don't know how not to be. And so why receive Jesus' question? Especially when, if we're honest, so often it appears that Jesus is asleep at the stern. What if the things that I have feared, the fears I have feared, have come true? What if I've asked him for rescue and the terrors remain. Why should I receive this question? And this leads us to the table. Because here at the table, shouting through the wind and the waves is this truth, that Jesus is not asleep. He is with us. He is with fearful people. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus was weighed down, burdened, distressed by the fear of death. In the face of the pain of the cross and the wrath of God that would be poured out upon him at the cross, he recoiled from it. And yet he feared a greater fear. He entrusted himself to the Father and cried out, "Not my will be done, but yours." And that is the cry of perfect courage. And he went down into the abyss of death in faith. And he did not perish, but he rose through the waves to a glorious peace because he cares for you and because he is with you. And here at the table, he invites you to be with him and to feed on his courage and to remember this truth. There is nothing so fearful that it can frustrate God's purpose for you. There's nothing so dreadful that it can end God's work to bring you to himself. There is nothing in all of creation that can separate you from his love. And if he is with you, you do not need to fear.